Stirring testimony today in Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane's criminal trial. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me with details is WHYY's Katie Colinari. And Katie, I understand prosecutors played a pretty revealing phone conversation in the courtroom today.
That's right, Dave. It was a conversation that was recorded by the FBI that took place in 2014 between Josh Morrow, a political consultant, and John Lisko. Lisko was being investigated by the FBI in a separate case, which is why the call was being recorded. It was part of a wiretap. And during that conversation, Morrow calls Lisko to sort of shoot the breeze. And the first thing he says is Kane called him that day to tell Morrow that her first deputy, Adrian King, had documents she wanted him to leak to a reporter.
What is the significance of the conversation?
Well, that leak is the exact thing that Kane is on trial for right now, because those documents are supposed to be protected by state law and they're confidential. And this call also directly contradicts what Morrow told a grand jury that investigated the leak. He testified three times before that grand jury, and each time he lied, saying that it was Adrian King, Kane's first deputy, who told him about the documents, not Kane. Today, Morrow admitted in front of the jury in Kane's criminal trial that he lied to protect himself and Kane, and that he was coming clean now. It's kind of important to note, too, that Morrow was testifying under an immunity order he got only yesterday, meaning that he can't be charged for anything he said in court today, which is probably why he was so revealing. And that was something the defense really harped on during the cross-examination.
Certainly, at this juncture, it doesn't bode well for Kane.
No, and it also corroborates another bit of shocking testimony we heard from Adrian King yesterday, who told the jury that Kane and Morrow were trying to frame him. He came off as rather defensive and angry to be there, and so this might legitimize his testimony for the jury. And besides that recorded phone call, we also saw text messages Morrow and Kane sent to each other before and after the Daily News article came out. That's the news article featuring the leaked documents. And in one exchange, they talk about revenge. King says, "What's that saying about revenge?" And Kane replies, "Best served cold." And in another, Kane asks Morrow, "Where's my story?" The jury has to believe that Kane is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And her defense team is going to have to do a lot of work to poke holes in a lot of what the prosecution presented today.
And given that job ahead, how much longer could the trial go on?
You know, it's not clear. We've heard from several key witnesses already, including a lot of former top aides of Kane, and the defense has not yet rested. But it's not clear whether Kane is going to take the stand in her own defense, which could lengthen the trial. We were expecting it to last at least throughout tomorrow, but it may be looking like it's going into next week at this point.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Katie Colinari on NewsWorks Tonight. Homeowners in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware are way behind on their mortgages. New numbers indicate that tri-state residents are more likely to be seriously underwater on their mortgages than the national average. WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains.
Being underwater on your mortgage means you owe more on the loan than your house is worth. Being seriously underwater means you owe at least 25% more than the house is worth. New numbers show that Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware are among the worst states for seriously underwater mortgages. Elizabeth Greenwood, a New Jersey housing counselor for the financial literacy nonprofit Clarify, says much of that can be attributed to a slow economic recovery in the area.
What's happening now is the unemployment, it's sort of still there, where people are still having trouble finding jobs and being able to pay that mortgage.
Darren Bloomquist, vice president of Adam Data Solutions, which calculated the numbers, has another idea. He says foreclosures are finally starting to pick up in New Jersey and Pennsylvania especially, but when foreclosed homes sell below market value, they also bring down the value of homes around them, while mortgage payments stay the same.
When an appraiser is estimating a home value of any given home, they're looking at recent sales of properties, and if there's two or three recent sales of these distressed foreclosure properties, that is going to be a drag on the value of the home that's being appraised.
Susan Wachter, a real estate professor at the Wharton Business School, says despite the high rates of underwater mortgages, they're still better than they were a few years ago.
The market is improving. In fact, we are near 2006 levels before the crisis. That's good news, except if you're in the market to buy a home.
In that case, Wachter says, you'd better prepare for a bigger down payment. Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The school district of Lancaster goes to court next week over allegedly failing to provide equal educational opportunities to student refugees in their late teens. The federal suit is the latest in a succession of similar cases across the country. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports.
About 170,000 school-aged refugees moved to the U.S. in the decade leading up to 2012. Since then, resettlements ramped up, but no one's tracking how young refugees fare in school once they're here. Georgetown University released a study earlier this year looking at education access by students with limited English proficiency. It focused on undocumented immigrants, but researcher Zananda Boy says some trends apply to refugees, too. Specifically, schools discouraging or denying enrollment, particularly to older children, and failing to translate when communicating with families.
It could be the lack of resources to adequately accommodate these kids. And in some other instances, it's essentially they don't want these kids in their schools. So to a large extent, districts are dealing with a lot in trying to accommodate these kids. But at the same time, though, it can't be used as a reason why you completely exclude a child from being able to access education.
But that's what appears to be happening in some places, as documented by the Georgetown study and lawsuits in multiple states, New York, Florida, and now Pennsylvania. Vic Walczak is the legal director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, representing six student refugees in a lawsuit filed a few weeks ago against the school district of Lancaster. He says the problem might go beyond refugees, but it's a refugee caseworker who contacted him about the issue after observing some patterns. One involves Phoenix Academy, a separate high school for students at risk for not graduating on time. The district's accused of sending refugees there automatically, even though they're supposed to be a process first.
The school district seems to have a good program for early language learners at McCaskey High School, and that program seems to be completely off limits to the students, and that not only makes no sense, but we're investigating whether or not that's illegal.
Before it was filed, I asked district officials about the lawsuit and other claims by refugee caseworkers. That the district turns away student refugees in their late teens, delays enrollment by weeks or months rather than the 5 days allotted by state law, talks to students and parents about major decisions, like dropping out without a translator present, and whether it's all linked to pressure to keep up the graduation rate. Lancaster superintendent is Damaris Rao.
We are not concerned that we are committing any type of errors in that area. We've really looked at our policies. We're doing everything we're supposed to do according to the law.
Public Interest Law Center attorney Michael Churchill has handled similar cases and says the law and its ambiguity are partly to blame.
Requirements in federal law, they essentially require that school district make meaningful efforts to provide equal educational opportunities, including translation services. But the scope of those requirements, I think it is fair to say, are much less clear.
The particulars are left to states. Pennsylvania Department of Education officials say schools have to take steps to support students based on their needs and district resources. Beyond that, details like how many hours of English language instruction students should get are guidelines based on best practices, not requirements. Then there's funding. There are federal school impact grants meant to defray the cost of refugee education. In Pennsylvania, they're administered by the State Office of Refugee Resettlement, headed by Charlotte Fry.
It's never a lot, and we do our best to distribute that money across the state to cities that are heavily impacted by refugees. And so the grants are very equally divided to all the recipients. They're $75,000 each. Lancaster has two.
That's barely enough to hire two teachers. So Lancaster fills in the gaps by partnering with outside organizations. Some of those programs are considered models, but tend to focus on younger children. Churchill, the lawyer from Philly, says it's critical to sort this out, court battles aside.
We all have a stake in making sure that children are educated so they become productive adults. And if you don't do that, if you exclude some because they have language problems or because they have disabilities or what have you, you are in the long run increasing the social costs for everyone.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
K-12 Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Still ahead this evening, a local company is providing tech for patients who struggle to keep their pills straight.
So what our goal was to just create a very simple service and provide that peace of mind to patients and their caregivers, that this would just be done for them.
Pill boxes are getting a lot smarter. Details as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. For patients with complicated medical conditions, keeping track of which pills to take and when to take them can cause lots of confusion. From the Innovations Desk, WHYY's Todd Bookman reports on how a locally produced smart pill box may be able to help.
About 50% of people with chronic health conditions, think diabetes or high blood pressure, fail to take their medications as prescribed. And that has major consequences, both in terms of keeping people healthy and keeping them out of expensive hospital beds. Lots of companies are working on this problem, trying to use technology to simplify the prescription process. That includes the Philadelphia-based startup TowerView Health. They're about to roll out an updated version of their device, a kind of smart pill box.
So what our goal was to just create a very simple service and provide that peace of mind to patients and their caregivers, that this would just be done for them.
Rahul Jain is CEO of TowerView. The company launched after a colleague diagnosed with leukemia realized just how hard it is to stay on top of a complicated pill schedule. The box, white and slick, is about the size of an iPad. Drugs arrive in the mail, pre-sorted in easy-to-open blister packs that slip into the case. Each 7-day supply is clearly labeled with the time of day you take it.
The pill box actually has sensors embedded in it that can detect when patients remove a dose of their medication. So if they don't take their medication by the right time, we can send the patient or their caregiver a friendly reminder.
That reminder can be a text message or a phone call. The unit also has an internal alarm, currently pre-programmed to play a little Justin Bieber through a scratchy speaker. Rather than selling to consumers, TowerView is targeting insurance companies. Patients get the unit for free, with insurers betting on savings from healthier patients. So far, the unit is only rolling out to select test groups, but they say it's simple enough that users only have to plug it in, no tech savviness necessary. The company hopes its new version will be in 1,000 patient homes by the end of the year. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Last week, I interviewed musician Carl Denson in advance of his appearance at the Peach Festival, set to get underway this evening in Scranton. Colorado-based String Cheese Incident is scheduled to perform there tomorrow night, and I caught up with guitarist Bill Nershey before it was learned that festival headliner Greg Allman canceled his appearance due to illness. Bill first reflected on his onstage role during this 2016 summer tour.
When times are dark, as they have been lately, I feel more like my job is important, that I'm not just loafing, that I'm actually trying to do something positive in the world. It's a privilege.
Pull the cord, ignite the dark, betray the dark, feed the dream.
You have always been known, String Cheese Incident, for giving it out and needing to get it back from those 3 or 30,000. Is it every bit as much a collaborative now as it was once upon a time?
Yeah, I feel connection with the crowd when we play music. Every night is a different incident, a different experience for us and the crowd that's listening.
Tell me about this new venture, Sound Lab.
SCI Sound Lab began when we found a place in Colorado that is working as a warehouse and a studio and an umbrella for many of the different companies that we have, and we've already begun recording songs there.
Now, some of the first songs, though, that you've treated listeners to through your website were derived from a session, I believe, last year in Sedona, Arizona.
Sedona. It's a beautiful area. It's visually is amazing.
There's a dawn, rise up early, lift your song. From the breath of life that rises from the glowing stone.
we had a week to just be together as a band and throw around ideas for songs, to have all our instruments set up and jam. And it was such a great experience that we decided that every year we're going to take a trip somewhere for a musical retreat. And we have now so many songs lined up that we can make into recordings at the Sound Lab. We're not necessarily putting out albums now, but we're putting out songs three at a time, one at a time, however it works out. You know, the worst thing when you record is if you record an album and it takes a year, and it often does, a year, maybe even more, to get that album out. By the time it comes out to the people, it's old news already. And this provides us with a way to get the idea out to the listeners while it's still fresh, so that they can check it out. And then when they come see a show, we'll bust out a new tune and they'll say, yeah, this is that tune. I've been listening to this, you know, on SoundCloud or whatever it may be. And they're busting it out. And that's really cool.
200 gigs a year, 150 gigs a year, whatever.
That was that's a little low, actually. We had 2 years where we were over 200 shows a year.
And understandably, I'm not sure of the chronology, but I think around 2007 you took a hiatus. And now you're back together, and it's just great. But those who've been with you for the long time, many are holding their breath going, I don't want them to burn out again. We love them so much. And not that I'm asking you to sign a contract saying you're going to do it for 25 more years. But it sure sounds like you and the guys are in a really good place right now.
Yeah. The band is in a good groove. And I think we reached a burnout point, and we had to kind of shut it down and reassess and look at how our lives had changed, you know.
So talk about rehearsals now. Is it because there's such a flood of new material that that's what you're working up in, on the potential of breaking out a song or developing a song that night? Or has that been your modus forever to be this intensive with day of show rehearsals?
We've always been a band that rehearsed a lot. And we get together before we go on tours, and we spend a week or two preparing material, talking about what songs we might play.
Is it a whole different level of preparation when you embark on something like a Kool and the Gang or a Doobie Brothers incident?
Yeah. It takes a lot of work, and you don't want to mess it up. And these are the kind of shows that we will remember years from now. People that have laid the groundwork for bands and written the songs that bands cover now, and it's a real treat to be able to share the stage with people like that.
Is there a whole menu of bands who would cite String Cheese as primary mentors?
Well, I've had guitar players come up to me and say, thank you, you've really influenced my guitar playing a lot, and I don't like to toot my own horn about anything, but it means that we're getting older.
But not in the way.
Not in the way.
Billy, you've been very generous. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Look at where we are. 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 Does it go from here?
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.